Good morning. We will call to order the House Interim Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness. Today is Thursday, January 16, 2014. We appreciate you being there. To the hundreds in the audience and to the millions of viewers at home, welcome. We are just slightly delayed today, and we apologize for that. We have a couple members that are tied up, and they'll be here soon. One is on the freeway and making their way through traffic, so hang in there with us. And what we'll do is we'll go through a couple of the LC comments, I think, first is what we'll do. We'll talk about the concepts coming forward for the February session, and then if we get one more member, we'll be able to do a work session quickly, and then we'll go right into our informational hearings if we can. So with that, I want to thank Ms. Ross for attending the committee, obviously, and being our administrator. She's done phenomenal work in the interim, doing more than one job, and we sure appreciate that. And so with that, I will defer to her as she's going to kind of walk us through some of these LCs that we see before us. They are all in OLIS too, just so you know, and very efficient. So if you have any questions about these, you have copies in front and also on OLIS. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the three committee concepts you'll be hearing from me about today are LC 133. This will be familiar to the members because it is very similar to House Bill 2086 from 2013, the lottery raffle to benefit veterans. LC 134, which is a placeholder for improvements to House Bill 3207 from 2011. Members will also recall this. We had an informational hearing during November legislative days. Primarily Boley and Das came to testify. Changes are underway right now to this draft. It's simply a vehicle for them to put language into. LC 140 clarifies an ambiguity that was discovered during the 2013 hearings on Senate Bill 34. Members will recall that bill increased the number of home loans that ODVA could offer veterans from 2 to 4, and the ambiguity they discovered during those hearings was as to the amount. Was it 417,000 per loan or 417,000 total amongst the loans? The clarification is 417,000 per loan. That's all that LC 140 does. Those are the three committee concepts.
Wonderful. And I did talk to Boley yesterday a little bit about LC 134 and still working with DAS through that. You know, our desire is to get those things kind of ironed out and set forth before we come forward and do the best work on behalf of our veterans. I think they're committed to trying to find the solutions that make that make sense. There was a work group initially, you all might recall, a couple years ago when this first came about, and we're still trying to work through. There's the bill, the written law, and then there's the interpretation that some folks are having a hard time with. And I think the intent is solid. I think that we're just trying to find out what the easiest way to make this clear for everybody to interpret it appropriately as veterans go forward for jobs. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the unfortunate thing about this situation is that the private sector does, in fact, look towards veterans to hire. The real problem is the public sector. It always has been ever since I've been on this committee. And I think that's just a shameful thing for the state of Oregon to have people that resist giving our veterans a chance to have an opportunity to go to work for the state. And I think it's unfortunate that we have to come forth with a bill making them do so.
I agree, and we have said that often, that it's a private and public, and the private does a great job. The public is, you know, for a multitude of reasons, sometimes difficult. And the thing I find, I guess, most upsetting is that it's not consistent throughout the state, and it really needs to be. You know, whether you're applying at a certain county or the state or a city, you should be treated the same, regardless of which county or city or state that, you know, state institution that might be. So we'll be working on that. And with that, do we?
And you can reopen the work session.
Okay.
Members are running.
Great. Any other comments on that? And again, the placeholder also that we heard is 133. That was on the lottery raffle. And so, again, talking about, you know, directing the Oregon Lottery to come up with a game specific to veterans, which would be basically a raffle game. So that continues to be the push, and we'll see what we can do, and hopefully we can get that done in February. So I appreciate that. Any other comments from any of the members? And with that, Ms. Ross is informing we have the quorum, so we can move forward if you're comfortable.
Or you can go straight to work session.
And we can go to the work session. So with that, we will close our quick informational on the LC concepts, and we'll open a work session for the purpose of introducing the legislative concepts. And I will defer to the Vice Chair, Representative Fagan.
Can you do that first?
Oh, I certainly can.
Anyone?
A vote in favor, merely introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It's not indicative of a member's opinion or position, if any, on the content of the measure, simply to get them forward.
Chair Matthews, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 133, dated January 15, 2014. LC 134, dated December 12, 2013. LC 140, dated December 12, 2013.
Thank you. Representative Fagan has moved that their legislative concepts just recited be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the concepts will be introduced as committee bills. And I understand, too, we can reopen that work session once our colleagues join us and give them an opportunity to get on there as well. So thank you for that. Good morning. Oh, we just thought we were early.
Well, for some reason I had it down at 8:30, and then I just thought, Julie, just know you're late. So she's coming.
She's heading this way as well. Well, thank you. And what we'll do, Representative Boone, is we'll reopen that work session to introduce those committee bills to move them over.
Oh, you've already
Once the committee comes in.
Yes. I should have known you'd be on time. Sorry.
It's Ms. Ross. We are very, very efficient. And with that, we will move to... Should we move down and head to our...
I already did that.
Yes. And so we'll close the work session, and we will now open up the informational meeting, and we'll begin with our Fusion Center update, and welcome our Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum. So if you'll please join us, Mr. Attorney General, we appreciate that, and thank you, Madam, for being here, and we'll open an informational hearing on the Fusion Center update. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Matthews, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum, and I'm the Attorney General for the State of Oregon. And I come before you today to speak about the Department of Justice's Criminal Justice Division, the challenges faced by that division, and the opportunities I see going forward. I also have with me this morning my Chief of our Criminal Division, Darren Tweet, to provide you with a short update as to the status of the Fusion Center, which acts as a clearinghouse for anti-terrorist intelligence and data sharing between the federal government, the various states, and local law enforcement. So what I'm going to do is turn first to Darren and have him give you that update. And then if there's time and if you would like to hear some additional information about the division more generally, I do have a short presentation on that, but I want to conserve your time. So why don't we start with that, since that's how you have presented it on your agenda, Representative Matthews.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Matthews, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Darren Tweet. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice. The Fusion Center, as the Attorney General mentioned, is an information clearinghouse relating to primarily domestic and foreign extremists. What we do with the Fusion Center program is bring together law enforcement agencies, both federal, state, and local, in order to collect information relating to extremist activities and make sure that the information is passed to the right investigatory parties. So, for instance, we may receive a tip from the Portland Police Bureau relating to a suspected plot to do some sort of extreme activity, and we would pass that tip to the appropriate federal authorities and make sure that that tip is followed through with. That's one of the roles that we play with the Fusion Center. The other and very important role for Oregon law enforcement and for all of your communities is the role of protecting officers throughout the state. And we do that by providing information about officer safety. So we release bulletins constantly relating to concealment methods, relating to people who have anti-law enforcement tendencies or who have even made threats against law enforcement, and and those types of activities. During the last biennium, the Fusion Center ran into some budgetary problems, which some of the members of this committee may be aware of because we talked about them throughout the building last biennium. And that was related to the fact that this is a grant-funded program. It's funded through pass-through money from the United States Department of Homeland Security, and that pass-through money goes to the Office of Emergency Management and is given to us as part of the state Homeland Security grant. The Department of Justice has four criminal intelligence analysts that are paid for through this program, and they are the backbone of the Fusion Center. Their role is integral to the collection and distribution of the information that I've talked about. During the last biennium, with all of the federal budget difficulties, we ran into some grant funding issues. And during the last part of the biennium, we were very concerned that we would have to, and in fact started the layoff process for the four intelligence analysts that we have. Fortunately, we were able to work with the Oregon Military Department and the Office of Emergency Management, who administers the program, and come up with a workable solution to retain the backbone of the program. And I do want to thank the Office of Emergency Management for what they've done to try and help us sustain the program over the course of the past few years. Unfortunately, we're here today not to report all of our successes but in that regard, but to let you know that we're still in this kind of grant funding cycle. As you all know, through your experience here, you cannot sustain programs long-term with federal grants. We're concerned that we may run into the same problem that we ran into last biennium with this program. So the Attorney General, I know, will talk later on about a request that she'll be making to the legislature for relating to not just the Fusion Center, but for several other programs that we have in the Department of Justice. We're seeking sustainment of this important program for Oregon law enforcement. That is the Fusion Center update, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Great. Questions from the members? My question would be, the current grant now, what's the timeline on that? When does that expire?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the question. That grant is a yearly grant, and so we operate on the fiscal year, and we constantly seek renewal of the grant. I will tell you that because it's a yearly grant, managing that has been difficult, as you can understand, with our biannual budget in Oregon. And I will also tell you that we projected that we would run short during this biennium. Fortunately, we have lost a position. A person in the Fusion Center has taken a new job. So we're going to keep that position open. We're now reduced to three criminal intelligence analysts for the entire state of Oregon in this program. And that's the way that we project that we will be able to at least make it through the end of this biennium, simply on the state Homeland Security grant money.
Thank you. And I would imagine, Madam Attorney General, that we're going to hear about how we can try to stabilize some of that funding so we can project forward more than an annual basis. I believe, Representative Esquivel, you have a question?
I'm just curious, what is this total amount for this center cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, members of the committee, I believe it's about $600,000 a year. I can get you the exact numbers following this. It's really a pittance, and I shouldn't say per year, but during the biennium. We don't request very much money. It's four criminal intelligence analyst positions for the entire program.
Follow up. You mentioned other programs to be incorporated with this request. What is the total on this, and how many programs are you speaking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, members of the committee, we understand that in the Senate Veterans Committee there is going to be a bill. There is a legislative concept, LC-138, which sets out the request for the Department of Justice. There are several different programs. I've run through them quickly. The Criminal Justice Division Operations, and the Attorney General will speak at greater length to the operations of all of the Criminal Justice Division programs that are identified here. But in any event, the Criminal Justice Division Operations, $1.1 million. Criminal Justice Division Organized Crime Section, also of which I am head, $1.9 million. The Fusion Center, $600,000. We also run an anti-child pornography task force, which is called the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. The Attorney General will speak more to that if you wish. $1.2 million. And then as part of this package, during the late part of the winter of 2013, the Attorney General took a tour of several of the distressed counties in southern Oregon, the timber counties, and talked to elected district attorneys, elected sheriffs, chiefs of police, and other community members who are concerned about the state of law enforcement or the lack of law enforcement and boots on the ground in those counties. And as part of our tour, we learned really how devastating the recent economic crisis has been in those counties and what the lack of law enforcement really means. So as part of this legislative concept, there is a provision for grants to the district attorneys for if there is a state of emergency declared in their county, and there's also a provision for grants to the for funding to the Oregon State Police for troopers if there is a state of emergency declared in those counties. So maybe a little bit more than that. Any other questions?
Another follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Madam Attorney General, if you'd like to sit down and discuss about what's going on in those counties, because there's a couple of counties down there that are in dire straits, right. We'd be glad to, because I grew up there and I've watched it for years. So.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Esquivel. As Darren Tweet just mentioned, we have been doing an AG tour of the state and focused so far on the southern counties in particular because our concerns about the distress that they have experienced in light of the reduction in the timber monies and such, and clearly boots on the ground are fewer and fewer in those counties. And while we are not the boots on the ground, what we can do is, and what we do very well, thanks to Darren and his staff, is we provide the backup, the expertise that will allow them and help them to do their jobs. And we team up and we collaborate with local law enforcement throughout the state. We have done that very successfully recently, for example, and this is just one of a number of examples, in Klamath Falls, where we were able to conduct a very high-level, wiretap-based investigation that resulted in some 40 arrests of individuals fairly high up, not the highest level, but kind of that middle range where we're able to actually disrupt an active drug cartel that is doing business in our state, and we are in the process of prosecuting those folks down in Klamath Falls. That's an example of the type of case that we have the expertise to bring, that we have the team approach, because we have not only prosecutors, but we have analysts and investigators all within our Department of Justice, our CJ unit. And it's very, very effective and helpful to those boots on the ground when they do their work, especially when there's so few of them. So that's really our approach, is not to duplicate, not to steal away jobs, believe me, but rather to help, to provide assistance, and to team up. And that's what we did in that case. At one point, I think the night of the arrest, there were some 300 assistants from state and local law enforcement to assist in those arrests. We work very well together. But frankly, we don't any longer have the ability to do what we feel we can and need to do in order to help keep our streets safe. And that's why we're coming back to the legislature now rather than waiting until next year. We understand the difficulties in making these priorities, and we appreciate all that you do in this regard.
And members, I'm told it's LC-138. It's on OLIS, and that'll be going to the Joint
Ways
and Means. It'll be the funding mechanism for that. So, Representative Esquivel?
Well, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that the Attorney General, thank you very much, answered some of my question, but it sounds like you're coming for 2015, or is this for 2014?
This is for 2014.
14.
This is an attempt to bolster our current resources in CJ, having experienced some losses. We're actually trying to play some catch-up because we recently suffered the loss of two of our attorney positions, due to, obviously important priorities that were determined at this last session. But we're basically back with the support of Senator Boquist, who has put together this proposal. It is actually somewhat less than what we had asked for at the last session. However, I will also mention that because this is my highest priority and my commitment to my criminal justice division, I have, as you know, we've been asked to indicate where we would, if we could get the 2% that has been withheld returned, where we would be asking for that to go. And my request is for it to all the 1.2 million, which is our 2% potentially, to go to our criminal justice division. So I hope that sends the message to you and to the Ways and Means Committee that this is our highest priority and our a dire need. It's not just something we want. It's something that we feel we really have to have in order to do our job. Otherwise, we are going to have to basically start saying no to a lot of requests that we get from district attorneys. We assist district attorneys all over the state. At any given moment, we're not only running DA's offices. Currently, we're running the Lincoln County DA's office while there's a transition to a new DA. We recently ran the Klamath Falls district attorney's office while there was a transition. But we handle aggravated murder cases. We handle complex financial crimes cases. We handle what we're asked to do by the DAs, but unfortunately, we're not any longer in a position to be able to always respond affirmatively. And perhaps most significantly, when we're asked to do wiretap investigations, which is one of our areas of expertise that other local law enforcement simply can't do, we have to queue them up. We can do them, but we can only do about two a year. And that's just not enough. When you think about, I mean, I could turn to Darren and have him explain to you what we know is out there that we could be doing were we to be able to have the additional resources to assist local law enforcement.
Quick follow-up.
Yes, absolutely.
And thank you for explaining that, because you did now answer a lot of it. That what I was concerned about was if it was going to be for 2015, is there some way we can help them do a bridge in that sense? Because it sounds kind of urgent. And three people for the state for your intel just seems like not quite enough. And I worry about their safety and, you know, and all this. And I didn't know how, if it was all drugs or whatever, but you never know. So...
yeah. Well, obviously, we'll be back in 2015 if it's not possible to accomplish our goals in this short session. And we appreciate that this is there's a lot of competing, very, very important concerns. The Department of Corrections, DHS. There's just so many that contribute to the public safety.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And something as critically important as this, to put it on a one-year budget, hoping for a grant to be renewed, is probably not the most effective way to provide, you know, safety to our community. So thank you for that. Any further questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment that appreciate ever so much the good and hard work done by your office. And Mr. Chairman, I think that we want to make absolutely certain that Oregon is not open for crime.
Absolutely. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And did you have...
Well, you know, your questions have been so good. They were sort of softballs for me in the sense that I was able to provide my remarks, Mr. Chair, without necessarily referring to them. So with your indulgence, I think that really concludes what I was hoping to be able to present to you this morning. And I know you have many other items on your agenda.
Well, I'll tell you, we sure appreciate your time and making
Thank
yourself
you.
Available today. And I think, you know, from my perspective, I look forward to supporting you in this endeavor, and I know how critically important the role is, and we have to be working with other communities, and we have to be working with other law enforcement agencies, and I appreciate the great work you're doing. So thank you for everything you're doing, and let's see how we can assist. So
thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Absolutely.
Have a good day.
Have a great day, and keep up the great work. Thank you, ma'am. Wonderful. And so with that, we will close the informational meeting on the Fusion update, and we'll open.
You
did. Okay, we can certainly do that. Members, we're going to reopen the work session momentarily, but before we do, I see that the good representative, Gene Wisnett, has joined us, and we're going to give him a moment. He wants to kind of roll out a bill that he's got coming forward, and he'd like to see if we can get some support behind it. So he's just going to introduce a concept to us, and so with that, we'll just go back to the informational meeting, and we'll give the dais to Representative Wisnett. Feel free.
Good morning, welcome. Chair and committee members. For the record, Representative Gene Wisnett, House District 53. I'd like to compliment each of you for all your good work for veterans and their families. I learned about Maryland, the state of Maryland's bill that they passed saying put all veterans back to work. And so I said, let's do that in Oregon. And I hadn't checked my paperwork to see that you had done a lot of that. And so you did some in the last two sessions. So with the help of LC, what we've drafted and ask your committee to support is we've asked those agencies that do license people from anything from truck driving to teachers and medical doctors that they report back to us on how the program's working and see if we need more legislation to get this started. We need to get our veterans back to work. So that's basically what the bill does, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the time, and I hope we'll get it to you. I think the bill's ready, so we'll drop it soon.
Thank you, sir. And that's on OLIS, and that's LC-60, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Correct. And were there any questions of the committee members?
No, thank you.
And if you would indulge us, I kind of like to highlight our member services as well. If you'll just please, remind us you're a veteran yourself and a career military. So could you just please let us know your service, your rank, and what you did for us in this great nation?
I can't tell you because you'd have to do it.
No, feel free.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it's an honor to serve. I served in the United States Air Force uniform for 27 and a half years. I served in the Pentagon for over 9 years. That was my most dangerous assignment. But I served in Vietnam, Germany, and Yugoslavia. And in Yugoslavia, I was a senior military officer during the beginning of that war. And did some spying.
You see Mad Magazine, Spy versus Spy? That's the instance of the spy.
Well, and thank you.
It was an honor, sir.
Thank you for your service to the country, and thanks for your service to the state. I really enjoy working with you, sir. Any questions of the good representative?
Well, I think he forgot. Did he say he was a colonel?
He did not say he was a colonel, but,
right, I think
but
that's
we'll remind him that he
I'm
was
very,
a colonel.
I'm very, very proud of him.
My wife reminds me, sir, she's a general.
I heard the general giving you a few orders this morning in the parking garage, sir. Yes. Wonderful. Well, thank you for your time this morning, and thanks for rolling that out. And I believe you might even have the bill back with you. Is that correct?
No, it's up in the office.
Okay, great. We'll find her later. Thank you, sir. Now, we can reopen the work session. We'll reopen the work session for the purpose of the introduction of the LCs. And so, we need to go back through the... we'll reopen the work session for the purpose of measure introduction.
In order to record the votes of the members who were initially absent, and Mr. Chair, if those members would like to quickly go through any of those LCs, I'm happy to. Otherwise, you would simply
record. Wonderful. And would that be a benefit to the members that weren't present earlier? Great. And again, a vote in favor of merely introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It's not indicative of a member's opinion or their position, if any, on the content of the measure. It's simply to get them introduced and to move them forward. And so with that, I believe we can go through the vote. So Representative Parrish.
Yes.
You vote yes, and do you have any objections to any of the measures? No. Representative Witt? Representative Witt indicates yes.
I vote.
And no objections.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Representative Boone?
Yes on all.
Yes on all, and no objections. Thank you. They are now unanimous by the committee, and we will close the work session, and the concepts are introduced as committee bills. Thank you for indulging. Appreciate that. And thank you, members, and glad everybody was able to arrive safely. Mm-hmm. We will next move into our informational hearing on the PSAP consolidation. We'll get an update from Dave Stuckey, Director, Oregon Office of Emergency Management. And welcome, sir. Good to see you, and appreciate that. I understand you went through this with the Senate committee previously, so you're all warmed up and
absolutely
worked out the kinks, and now you're ready to go for us.
Well, thank you for the invite. I very much appreciate it. For the record, I'm Dave Stuckey, Director of the Office of Emergency Management, and with me here today is...
Good morning, Chair Matthews, Vice Chair Fagan, and Parrish. For the record, I'm Mark Tennyson with Office of Emergency Management. I'm the Section Manager of Technology and Response Services, and part of that division includes the oversight of the state 911 program.
Great. Thank you.
Just a few slides here this morning, Chair Matthews, and members of the committee. I want to go back and review the policies that existed and some of the changes that happened from the 2013 legislative session. First one of great importance here was the extension of the tax and the sunset to December 2021. That clearly was a main priority. Very appreciative of that. We still believe there's some refinement that could work in that, and we'll get to the priorities of what we think we would like to see moving forward. The second bill that was of great importance, public safety bill. Chair Matthews, I believe you testified on the multi-line telephone system bill that allowed a greater sense of location for our first responders as they went to large campus settings that had a large phone bank in it. And so a very, very good bill. Very appreciative of that. Our priorities in the Office of Emergency Management, first and foremost, would be some equitable collection of the 911 services tax for every device. Not going to drag this out into prepaid point of sale versus carrier remit. That's a policy decision. That's your decision. All I would like to say is I'd like to see an equitable solution across the board for every device that is able to reach the 911 service. The second priority that we have been working with the Legislative Fiscal Office on, as well as DAS CIO. We received a budget note, and this is on the next generation. Next generation project is of great importance to us and our stakeholders. This will be the most important technological change that we have had in the 911 service delivery service system for some time. And with that, I would like to defer to Mark Tennyson with some overview on that.
Sure. Again, good morning. Thank you, Chair Matthews, Vice Chair Parrish, and Fagan. To add on to what Director Stuckey has mentioned, we did receive a budget note at the end of last session, and without reading the whole note verbatim, primarily it gave the Office of Emergency Management conditional approval to continue to move forward with our project on NextGen. However, we were asked to go through the process of working with LFO's office as well as the DAS CIO process, which included reviewing and producing foundational project management documents to support the project, including a business case, an IRR, and a charter, and so forth. So we have done that. We're in the process of that right now. We had a very productive, I think, positive meeting Monday of this week at OEM, included all those stakeholders, DAS CIO as well as LFO, gave progress. We provided feedback right before Thanksgiving on those documents that we were asked for. The budget note actually asked for those by December 1, so we met that date. We reviewed those basically on Monday and went through the feedback. Is it perfect? No, we have work to do still, and so we're closing in on those gaps, and we were given good progress on a green light to continue on, so it's been a good team effort, and what we hope to do is to be able to seek final authority on those sometime mid-year of this year.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Chair Matthews, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. Next slide.
Sorry.
Quick consolidation update. Those that have been a part of this process for a while have known that back in the 80s, we had upwards of 280 plus in primary service answering points in this state. In 1995, that was dramatically reduced to 62. About a year and a half ago, we had 49, and now we're at 45. And so we spent a great deal of time had a fairly complete and concise reports that in 2011 and 12 by the Kimball Group, Some of it was a result of budget notes, some of it was just good work that needed to be done. And the short answer was is that all of the PSAP consolidation constructs, generally speaking, needed to occur at the local level initially, and as well as it was occurring naturally and has been for some time and will be in the future. And so the position that the Office of Emergency Management has taken is that particular stance, that this is something that the locals need to derive from first. Generally speaking, the tax that is a result of that 75 cents per device that exists now results in about $79 million per biennium, and that is roughly 60% of it, 60.5, goes to the PSAPs, and that is about 25 to 30% of an operating budget for the PSAPs across the state. The remainder is local money from their own sources. And so from the standpoint of our position, we have seen this, we will support it. We certainly have a big hand in consolidation efforts to ensure that systems are combined. But at this point in time, we believe it's natural and it's local. And it continues. These are some discussions that exist today, both in Umatilla County as well as Malheur. We expect the next generation project will help speed that up to a certain degree, but at this point in time, that concludes my briefing, and I open up to any questions that this committee may have.
Great. Thank you both for being here, and thanks for your presentation both to the Senate and to us, and preparing us for the discussions in the future. Any questions from the committee? No questions? I will state this. In terms of the 911 tax system, I'm not here to make a ploy for anything other than the fact that, whatever the collection methodology turns out to be, leaving this on the table, I think, and going through the session without doing anything would be, again, the wrong approach. So I hope that we can deal with it. I hope that some folks out there are committed to the process of finding a way. Because there are some inequities out there that are really hurting the system right now. So I appreciate you bringing that forward and having that discussion. And again, regardless of the position methodology, I think we should all agree that it needs to happen in some fashion. It's timely now. Any further discussion? Any comments? Any questions? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it. And thanks for your great work.
Thank you.
Okay. Is Michelle Matthews in the audience? Okay. I believe she's en route. We did tell her we are running just a little ahead of schedule, which is, and so with that, we can, what we'll do is, Cheyenne's willing to summarize the Senate bills, too, to give us a little heads up as, in terms of what they are moving forward as committee bills, too. So we'll close our informational meeting, and we appreciate the update again. And Ms. Ross, if you would kind of let us know what happened yesterday in Senate Vets, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, most of you are aware I staff both the Senate and House side Veterans Committees. We, on the Senate side, introduced three concepts as well. You've heard of one already when the Attorney General and Mr. Tweet testified. That's LC 138, but it won't be re-referred back to a Veterans Committee. That is the appropriations discussion to keep the Fusion Center open. The other two LCs that were introduced on the Senate side are that we may see or not in this committee. LC 136, it excludes veterans' disability income from calculations of spousal support. The draft was requested by the constituent of a member. It could go to the Judiciary Committee. And LC 137, this is also a concept that will be familiar to members. If it reaches a Veterans Committee, it could also go to an Education Committee. It enables Oregon to join the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children. It's been tried twice before, previously in 2009 as House Bill 2348 and in 2010 as House Bill 3679. The current draft in LC 137 is slightly different. It was expanded to include drill duty officers in addition to active duty officers, which will benefit service members who come to Oregon or who are in Oregon. The other difference this time is that when it was originally before the legislature had very few states, 8, 10 in that neighborhood, who had signed on. And the benefit of an interstate compact is that if a lot of states sign on, the benefits are available from state to state. And now I believe the number, if I recall, is somewhere up around 46 states, and Oregon is one of the last four. So it has a better chance in the eyes of the Department of Defense to succeed this time. So those are the LCs that may be coming from Senate side.
Great. So we'll look forward to the discussions on those and find out where they go. And you said that LC 138 will not be coming to us. It'll be to Joint Ways and Means, and we'll see it there. Okay. Great. And I think also we have a little bit of time if there are some possible member bills that might be introduced that you would expect might come through this committee that might kind of help to throw those out. And if you want to, Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Working on a couple of things. I'm not sure if they'll end up in this committee or not, but they quite possibly could. Ms. Ross is working with me to try to identify a relating clause for a bill. There's a gentleman that's a VSO, has a fairly significant caseload out of the Bend area. And for 100% disabled veterans, along the vein of medical marijuana for PTSD, the annual cost of the medical marijuana card, he feels is cost prohibitive. In past sessions, we have made exceptions for other categories to be able to get a discounted rate for the medical marijuana card. And so his concept would be to include 100% disabled veterans in that exception to get a reduced rate, annual rate on the card. The other concept, working with Warm Springs, is for highway signage for Warm Springs veterans along a portion of Highway 26 in the Warm Springs area. And I'm working with Betsy Imholt from ODOT. There are two bills out there with proper relating clauses, and we think we might be able to get that in. Again, they may or may not come to this committee, but it's quite possibly likely they could.
Yeah, and it's my understanding, too, that Representative Olson is working on, he's kind of got somewhat of a work group informally, I think, towards the medical marijuana situation maybe. So there may be a vehicle there as well. I don't know that. But
thank you. I'll visit with him on that.
But we also have a broad relating clause related to veterans, I believe, but we in this committee, and I don't know that it would make sense to add it into that bill as well. But if anybody can find a way, this is Gal right here to my right. So thank you. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
I'm just curious, what does a medical marijuana license cost a year?
$200 a year, I believe, is the fee.
What it is? Okay, for somebody on a fixed income, that can be
interesting. And welfare recipients, I believe it's $10 a year is the exception. No. We brought it way down for a couple of exception groups.
The other thing is on the medical marijuana, I'll go back, I think it was three or four sessions ago, we had 26 bills in with approached medical marijuana because we all know that it's gotten to the point where it's maybe used as a recreational thing instead of a medical in certain parts of the country. I know in ours it is. They worked on that for a couple of years, I think, and still could not come up with a bill that would satisfy what they all felt. Andy's, or Representative Olson's, worked on this now for I think 6 years, so hopefully we can get something in concrete and down in a bill that we can work with.
I think I can appreciate that. I know that one end of it, not to do with the medical marijuana, but just marijuana in general, is this the hash oils that I think Representative Olson and I share the same concern about in terms of their explosiveness and folks that are manufacturing those at home. And I know that there's a law enforcement contingent out there that would like to see the legislature deal with that. That wouldn't be in this committee. Any other bills that the members might have? I do have one coming out that is basically it'll extend that in-state tuition, House Bill 2058. We had been working with OUS last session, and this one, what it would do is it would extend it to graduate students. So it's furthering that into the grad programs. Zach Reeves, who does phenomenal work with me, has been taking a lead on working on that. In fact, as he walks in the door, that was just right on cue. But he's an amazing mind who's been committed to assisting our veterans as well. So I would expect that that may not come to this committee. It could, but it will most likely go to higher ed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Do we have a little extra time here? Because I'd like to ask our director on how we're progressing with the mirroring of federal loans versus ODVA loans. Remember, we've talked about that for 4 years now.
Yeah, we're certainly right now. Ms. Matthews is going to present the study for employment retention of veterans, and I don't believe she's here yet. So we have time. If Director Smith would like to join us. It's always nice to hear from him anyway, and to see what's going on in the world of our veterans.
Good morning, Chair Matthews, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I was chatting in the back. Did you want a general update on our efforts currently or a specific topic, Mr. Chair or Representative Escobar?
You were chatting, weren't you?
General will be fine. Like how are we doing in serving Oregon's veterans? And in terms of the landscape, the legislature as we move forward, I mean, you know, one of the issues is going to be this lottery fund. And I've heard from some folks saying, is that really the best we can do? You know, I mean, do you really want to fight the illness of PTSD with an illness of gambling? And to me, our approach as a legislature, if we're successful in the game format, the game has been proven not to be a gambling addiction. It's not. It is completely separate. In fact, the raffle is more. Folks are compelled to assist our veterans by purchasing that ticket, knowing that it goes to the veterans' cause and gives them a chance to win. All other games, as we know, are there for, you know, educational purposes, right? So beyond that, if you'd like to.
Purposes. And entertainment.
Investment purposes.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, from a high level, still amazing to me that I get to represent our veterans community and our military families as the director of the Department of Veterans Affairs. An incredible team that we have at the department level, but strong partnerships that are critical given that we've got interests across education, healthcare, employment, housing. And almost unprecedented, you know, we've got 320,000 plus veterans in Oregon. About 1 in 10 Oregonians are a veteran, not including kind of our family impacts and the broader impacts from those veterans. And almost unprecedented in our nation's history that we're serving four generations across five major wars. Not just the breadth of the issues that we address, but the differences within those range, whether our aging veterans from the Vietnam era as they get older, our World War II, our Korea veterans, still the bulk of our population, and then obviously the Gulf War and Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And I would say we have a lot of hope and a lot of optimism going into the new year in 2014, not just for this short session and the good bills that are driving the good work, whether it is on driving more dollars into community colleges to make our campuses receptive to veterans coming back, the newest generation, or if the veterans are re-engaging at the tail end of their career and looking to shift and get new training. On the education side, on the employment side, whether the public sector will have some preference discussions on the private sector, who wants to make sure they can give preference to veterans actively without running afoul of the law. But I think where I have the most excitement, and we will dig in and testify on all of these bills, whether it's the military family education compact that's been a long time coming, the raffle has been a long time coming, even just the data, kind of when we were discussing the Boley and Das discussions on employment, on the interview side for veterans, finally beginning to track the data, which is the base level of how many veterans does the state of Oregon employ. Not necessarily saying we have to have a quota or we have to have a certain metric to hit, but that we can begin to encourage our major agencies, whether Department of Corrections, DHS, ODOT, to raise their numbers and employ veterans not as a earned benefit or a charity, but that these folks are truly bringing their leadership, their values, their dedication, and their commitment to the work. We've seen what they can do on the battlefield and in the service of this nation, and it is simply shifting that service into a different realm as they reintegrate back home. Beyond the short session, we have had a lot of turnover at the department level. I think about 25%, both on our executive team and our frontline workers, retire. So we are an older tenured agency. So a lot of fresh faces at the department, and we're pulling together our executive team in strategy retreats to really build the long-term vision, making sure that we're aligned on our vision, our mission, our core values, not hard things for us to get wrapped around, and often those things grow out of our military culture, and then we put our civilian spin on them as we take care of our veterans and military families, but then making sure that our goals, our objectives, and the strategies at a high level of how we're going to achieve that, both to shape the governor's budget and the throughout 2014, the governor's budget development for that 15, we're already thinking 15-17 biennium, not just on, you know, everyone needs more resources, don't take the 2%. We will do more with less and more with our existing resources, but we also think there's a ripe opportunity as the window is closing on Afghanistan, as we begin to draw down our forces overseas. You know, we are still a nation at war, even if on an everyday basis, it does not feel like that in our own communities. But there is a huge opportunity to align our partners from the county level to the state, to the feds, to the tribes, our public and private partners, the community colleges, nonprofits, our business community, our faith-based community, the National Guard, continued leader over the last decade. But some concerns as DOD draws down those resources, what we've been leveraging through the Guard will come home. The issues do not go away for our veterans and military families after that war, after the wars are end, have been finished, as we've seen for all of our previous generations of veterans. And we need to make sure that we've got the strategies, the policies, and the resources and the right people to do the good work for our veterans and military families. And just a lot of excitement right now, I think, at the department and with our partners in terms of that re-engagement, both for the governor's budget, the short-term 1 year, the longer 15 session, and really trying to tee up that 3, 5, 10, 20-year effort that we know it's going to take for our veterans to thrive in Oregon. And happy to take any questions.
Yeah, appreciate that. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cameron, I apologize if I missed it. I'm not suggesting that you're not communicating, because you're in here all the time and doing well. But over the years, you know, we're used to seeing Tom Mann and Nicole Heft and others. Who are the people right now that if I have a constituent need that I would reach out to first? Who's your legislative liaison?
So Chair Matthews, Representative Huffman, members of the committee, not surprising, I think, to any members here who have engaged with our leaders in the past, like Tom Mann, we almost had to, I think we actually did, break his job up into three positions, which is not surprising, I think, given his energy and commitment and leadership. So our legislative, our senior policy advisor dealing with legislation, our internal rules, our policy development is Ms. Lori Skillman. We poached her from the real estate board. She is not a veteran herself, but is bringing such a legal eagle, both strategic and very detail-oriented mindset to our work. Whether it's, you know, we've got 780 policies on the book at the books at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Clearly, those policies are not guiding our everyday work. Clearly, we are not updating those. So she's digging through on the policy level, making sure that the rules implementing the legislation that you pass and give us that strong guidance, that it is aligned, that it does send clear signals to the public and our partners. On the constituents, so kind of the constituent side, it often also feeds into our Veteran Services Division. So Tom Mann was the director, the administrator of that section, the VSD, Veteran Services Division. And now we have Eric Belt, who we poached away I say that positively, from Washington County. He's that more technical expert, the Veteran Service Office experience that he has helped lead and also been a VSO himself. So on the technical, veterans not getting their benefit, having an issue on health care, we will feed that into Eric Belt and often CC Lori, just because of the legislative communication. And kind of the only last thing I would say is the loan program also, the home loan program, separate and distinct from the federal VA, and was the original source for the department standing up in 1945, that used to report through the Veteran Services Division. Because that division is the heart and soul with all this claims and counseling and linking folks to their benefits and the other partners, we separated that program off into its own chain, reporting up through the deputy director and the director, because it is a core benefit in and of itself, but it also goes to the heart of how we have funded through other funds much of the good work for our veterans.
Quick follow-up. Mitch Sparks, is he still around?
So Mitch Sparks, within the Veteran Services Division with Eric Belt, both he used to run our Salem claims and has that Veteran Service Office expertise. He is now training and certification in outreach, which is that huge, you know, the Veteran Service Officers at the county level, a lot of the funds pass through that the legislature appropriates through us to the counties. And one of his big roles is making sure those folks are trained and certified, given that the expertise on this stuff doesn't always reside within the county structure. So some strong partnerships there through him. But that is a training, certification, and outreach is a huge program in and of itself. It's a core mission that we've seen as a strategy going forward, and it's one person trying to do that for 36 counties. So he is overworked and overtasked, and we're really looking at how do we shift even internal resources to begin to. That's going to be a value-added area that helps the counties, helps strengthen those regional services. I would say more often because of that. We want to emphasize that training and certification, so Eric would more likely task some of our state Veteran Service Officers at Salem and Portland Claims on the more tactical, how are we helping a veteran navigate a constituent issue.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Escobedo, then Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Lori is a veteran because she had to deal with realtors for a long time, so therefore I think she earned her stripes. The original question was, where are we at on the ODVA loans mirroring them with the federal loans? We had discussed this for now 4 years, I believe, and I was wondering what the progress is and what are we doing to achieve that goal.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Esquivel, we have a new loan program manager. Again, kind of this, you can see the new folks flowing in. Mr. Cody Cox, both bringing expertise from the housing and community services and the public sector, but also longtime mortgage private sector experience. And I think, you know, it goes to the heart. Most of our veterans are going to be familiar with that federal VA loan guarantee program. If you ask an average Oregonian veteran whether they know the State Department of Veterans Affairs has a lower interest rate loan program, probably not. So a lot of work that we need to do to simply drive our program, both to the veterans, to the mortgage bankers, to the brokers, to the real estate agents, and our broader community partners. On the specific of the federal VA loan and whether we as a big bank of ODVA can offer that as a corollary product, it has been often discussed. Some of the legislation out of the previous session gave us the flexibility to start moving forward in that direction, but does take some staffing. There are some unique criteria both on the underwriting side and on the servicing side that we're going to begin to get our structure aligned, not imminent that we'll pull the trigger on that product. But we think it will give us another avenue when a real estate agent or a broker or a parent or a family member or an influencer is sitting down with a veteran who's looking to get into a home. We want to make sure that we have, you know, if it's the lower interest rate that appeals to the veteran, we've got that product aligned through our current system. If it's the loan guarantee that reduces the down payment zero down or low down payment, we want to be able to offer that as a corollary product. So not imminent, but definitely will go to the heart of our program, knowing that with 2,000 some loans on the books, we need to grow this program sustainably, given that we haven't had the flexibility on refinance at the federal tax level. And that it's not just a benefit for our veterans, but it has been key to how we fund our agency and the good work going forward.
So where are we at with the mirror, get back to the mirror of the federal? The mirror of the federal is that it's 100% plus, I believe, the origination fees and so on and so forth have to be paid by the seller. And it is 100% loan versus I think we have a 97% loan, and which is up better than it used to be. It used to be 10%, 90% loan to value. Where are we at with moving that stick?
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Esquivel, my understanding is, and I'll double check it and circle back with both the committee administrators and all of you, but that was the flexibility that we drove through the last legislative session. Our current statutes did not allow us to do an over 100% loan. That is one of the criteria on the federal VA. We got that flexibility through legislation, and now it's beginning to align our operation, both on the underwriting and servicing side of our businesses, to be able to offer that product now.
Yes, sir. What about refis?
So, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, Representative Esquivel, refinance has been just it's beginning to change the dynamic. I'm not a housing market expert, but since 2008, well, just as one metric, it's been a refi market. 2013, ODVA drove $40 million in loans, over $40 million in loans. Comparison, I think 2012 was about $24 million, and as one other comparison, I believe it was either 2008 or 2009, $4 million in loans. I mean, it was like the Maytag repairman in the loans program at ODVA that year. It was simply not a new loan market in the depths of the housing crash and the recession. Many folks wanting to refi, as those interest rates drop, a natural inclination to get out of a 7-6% interest rate, and when it dropped down to 3-4%, interest rates are beginning to rise again, and over the next 5-10 years, seems like it will continue to rise, which will be, I think, a good environment for our product, still be able to have those tax advantage bonds that give us the ability to give a lower interest rate. But currently, how the money that we get through tax advantage federal bonds to be able to loan out to veterans and their families to get them into the home of their dreams, at the federal IRS tax code level, currently we don't have that flexibility on the to offer a refinance interest rate. I think we do have some flexibility within the first year of the loan, and we do have, and it's the qualified veterans mortgage bonds, the QVMBs, that are the largest source of our money that don't have that flexibility. We do have another pot of money that we call it pre-Ullman money, that is it's a much reduced pot, and it was always a tension, both under my predecessor, Director Jim Willis, and the leadership team at the time. Do we use those more flexible pre-Ullman funds we use to extend to Vietnam veterans who had a... We wanted to make sure it was a lifetime benefit that extended beyond the 25-year mark that there's a limitation on the QVMB bonds. So we used that pot to be able to draw that when that got voted by the people to extend it as a lifetime benefit. But we knew in that 4 million year in 2008 or 2009, if we had tapped those flexible funds for refinance, we would have burned through those funds so quickly. The demand was there. We were getting all the calls on refinance and not on the new loans, but we wouldn't be able to offer it consistently for all of our veterans. So we've always been trying to find that more flexible pot. Given that the federal IRS tax code, changing the tax code is not easy in a good year and has been even more challenging in the current environment back in D.C., the only qualifier, a long answer to a short question, but the only qualifier that I'd put on that is that our senior senator, Senator Wyden, is going to be slotted sit in as chair of the Finance Committee, which has large authority over the tax code structure. And correspondingly, it looks like Representative Ryan from Wisconsin would have a heavy influence on the House side, and on the other side of the aisle from Senator Wyden on those tax code finance changes. About five states have, and Wisconsin is another state that is one of the five that has a home loan, veterans home loan program. So we've got California, Texas, Oregon, Wisconsin, and Alaska. But the Wisconsin one is on hold due to some of the tensions within their program. But you potentially line up leadership of two key committees back in D.C. At the federal level, along with the weight that the larger representative, the larger representation that California and Texas have due to population. There may be an opening window to drive that change, but it also goes against some powerful industries and influence, whether on the private sector side and commercial banking. Refinance is a big business. We would love to be able to have the flexibility to offer that, and we will continue that two-track. Can we get lottery funds set aside and kind of a revolving fund that funds this operation or some other flexible source of funds, or can we get the federal tax code change?
Thank you, and we appreciate that. In the interest of time, we're going to get you out of the seat, but Representative Boone had a question.
Quickie, if you could just, thank you, Cameron, for updating us. If you could get us the information on your legislative liaisons so that we can have put that in our files. Thank you.
You came up here as a favor to us, and we appreciate that. That's a lot of information just off the top of your head. You're very impressive and do a great job for our veterans.
Chair Matthews, members of the committee, just wind me up and I'll keep going.
I understand that. All right. Well, have a great day, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your time. And with that, we'll move on. I believe that Ms. Matthews is here. So we are going to go open the informational hearing on SERV, Study for Employment Retention of Veterans. And I believe you've already made this presentation in the Senate, perhaps, and so you're familiar, but just if you'll state your name for the record and
yes,
feel free to start.
I am Michelle Matthews. I am on the SERV team at Portland State University. We have, and I appreciate you having us here in the House. I was not here at the Senate. This is my first time to the Capitol, so thank you for having me here.
Welcome.
Chairman and members of the committee, I would like to tell you a little bit about this exciting new grant that we've been awarded about 11 months ago. It's a $5 million DOD grant, and I believe I have a little presentation over here for you. Dr. Leslie Hammer is the primary investigator, and she has had over 20 years of experience in work-life balance studies. She does work at the Department of Psychology. She's an industrial psychologist. We have a team of about 20 people that encompass Portland State University, the VA Medical Center, and OHSU as well. So as I was saying, it's a groundbreaking study, and the reason why it's groundbreaking is because it's one of the only studies, actually the only study, that focuses on the civilian sector in teaching them how better to communicate with the military, with veterans and their families, and teaching them supportive behaviors that would be germane to the veteran population. You know, so often we hear about so many studies out there that are very valuable, but it's all revolving around, the veteran or fixing the veteran. And this is more of a community focus in getting people to meet the veteran and their families halfway. So in doing this, in teaching civilian employers supportive behaviors and in teaching them about military culture in order to bridge that gap between civilian and veteran, what we're going to be doing is not only increasing the work potential of veterans, increasing their retainment in the job. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on getting veterans jobs, but there's nothing out there that teaches them or their employers how to keep them in that job. And with an unemployment rate that's really quite high in here in Oregon, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, I think it's really important that we focus on retaining veterans in jobs when they get back from deployment. And one of the things that I like to tell employers when I go out and talk to them is when you go through this training, you will be able to say that, you know, you have become the employer of choice for a veteran, because a veteran will know that if they sign on with your firm or your organization, they're going to get the type of support that they require to be successful. And it's going to help them, yes, and their family, but it's also going to help your bottom line. So as I said, the support for the supervisors around this training includes emotional support, increasing the communication, solving the scheduling conflicts that revolve around people that are still in the Guard and the Reserves, modeling the health work-life balance, and of course there's always spillover to employees that are not veterans. You know, this study and this training program is based on an evidence-based program that Dr. Leslie Hammer has already developed and gotten very good feedback on. She worked with grocery workers and unions back east on the primary body of work that this is based on, which is supportive behaviors taught to supervisors. And they found that there was decreased anxiety among the workers, increased positive communication between supervisors and workers, and increased positive family interactions. And all this sounds very simple, and it's not brain science, but what is important is that there are supervisors out there that don't know how to communicate, that don't know how to be supportive. And it's really just a simple notion of teaching them how to be, you know, a human being and understanding that military culture component that a lot of them don't. So as I said, benefits for the veteran employees, better job satisfaction, stress reduction, better personal relationships, better mental and physical health. They will be compensated if they decide to enroll in this study. We have three surveys, $25 apiece. We also invite their family to get involved if they have a spouse, a partner. We invite them to take a battery of surveys over the year, and combined they can earn $350. So simply, we are looking for veterans that were deployed either domestically or overseas, currently employed at least 20 hours a week, and they must have a direct supervisor, obviously, because we have to work with that dyad. What we are looking for in Oregon are 500 dyads, one supervisor to one worker, or it could be one supervisor to three workers, but we do need a supervisor. And the employer also has to agree to participate in the SERVE project. So as I said, there's three main modules: veteran support and culture, family and personal support, and performance support. And the VSST works as a web-based program. It's self-paced, 1 hour. You have text, you have learning modules, there'll be quizzes after that, there'll also be some interspersed video modeling behavior. And then we are also going to do a pre and a post test to see just how effective this training has been on the supervisor. Additionally, we're going to be asking that supervisor to take part in about 5 minutes a day of behavior tracking, because we want to be able to quantify and qualify exactly what is changing in their behavior, if anything at all. Because at the end of this is a 5-year grant, we're going to be taking the feedback from the veterans and their families and the employer supervisors and honing this tool. This is a DOD-sponsored training, and we're hoping that if we get the results that we think we're going to get, that they will disseminate this nationwide. So as I said, the veteran feedback is over about a year. It's baseline 3 months and 9 months. We're going to measure everything from sleep, what they eat, their anxiety, their anger, their intimacy with their partner, basically everything that could be affected by their work life. So the bottom line really is, you know, this is a win-win. We're looking at 24.8% unemployment among veterans, and that's just in the age 18 to 24 bracket compared to their civilian counterparts. I think what this study can do is not only improve the bottom line for a company by stopping the cycle of retraining, rehiring, firing, rehiring, retraining, but also it can help the veteran kind of give them a a stepping stone back into the civilian sector. And it really forces the community to meet the veteran halfway. I myself am a veteran. I'm the daughter of a veteran. This work is very dear to my heart. And, I think that this is one way, a little way, that we can give back to the veteran community as employers. And since it is the only study in the nation, it's a really good opportunity for Oregon to get on board and for every county to get on board and kind of show that as a state we come together and we support veterans and we're looking toward the next 5 or 10 years. So far, we have been endorsed by Governor Kitzhaber, former Governor Kulongowski, Cameron, who just spoke, and the TAG. So we have been getting a lot of support. Recently, we just signed on Intel, which is a very big deal for us. We're very happy about that. But we're also looking at medium and small businesses as well. And I'm here today to tell you about this because I'm hoping that each of you in your districts know somebody that could possibly help us get the word out, maybe a company that would like to sign on, maybe some veterans that would like to participate. I think it's a great opportunity. It's definitely a feather in our cap. And on top of that, it's not just a decorative feather. I think it's going to really work. So with that, if there are any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the way you spell your last name, too. Nicely
done. It's quite fashionable.
Yes, questions, Representative Boone.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Michelle, thank you for a great report. My question is, has there been any thought in, or is there a piece of this study that works with the military and their training policies now in anticipation of the whole soldier's life in that sense of coming into the military, serving in the military, and then in retirement or in the Guard, or, you know, how does it fit with what we've already got so that you're not just, you know, dealing with what you're given in that sense with their having no connection in the after life of a soldier? And well, that's probably not really clear, but
Chair Matthews, Representative, members of the committee, I think what you're asking is, are we working in tandem with the military to... What we are doing is we are taking feedback. We've been working with the J9 team and other units. We do use their input in our training that will go forth to the employer. But as I said, this is training that is pretty much focused on the civilian employer and their supervisors. The veterans' involvement is valuable in their feedback. What I like to tell them is I want to give you this opportunity to have a voice. And as we're putting your supervisor through this training, you tell us, is this working? Do you notice a difference? Do you not? In doing that, we have to have a control group, which, of course, won't get any training, and then the ones that will. But eventually, the ones that are in the control group will be given that training. The only other aspect that I can speak to is there will be some supervisors that are veterans, and there will be some supervisors that, you know, have military experience, or, you know, we might even have some AGR. And they might have some very keen input. And, you know, we've also invited them to take part as well because we want both the people that are familiar with military culture and those who are not, so we can get that whole picture. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, a little follow-up.
Yes.
And I think it does, and I think that's what I was hearing about. If you have employers or supervisors who are veterans themselves,
yeah,
have some service. Say Representative Esquivel hires somebody. I'm just making this up. But, you know, he served in Vietnam, so he might have a different experience than someone who served in the Gulf Wars or in Afghanistan, for
right,
the difference between maybe him and Cameron Smith.
Right.
And so I guess, yeah, I'm starting to figure this out now. So I guess I was going to ask you, do you give them, those guys are one thing, but the people who haven't served in the, and are the ones who are pretty virgin in that sense, did they get an introduction to, okay, this is what your employee has been through having been in the in the military. They've served this kind of thing. They're used to these kinds of situations,
right,
et cetera. You
right
can probably rely on them for this and that.
Right, right. Very good questions. We are primarily in this grant focusing on the OEF, OIF era. To answer your question, yes, the military culture component of the training will be focused on the different branches, the cultures, the history of the conflict, what they've experienced, the strengths they've gained from serving. I am the lone social worker on this team, and so I prefer to come from a strengths-based perspective. You know, I always tell people there's so much stigma around the veterans, but the truth is it only affects about 30% of them. I want to show the employers what the veterans come to the workplace with, the strengths that they offer, and how best the employer can utilize that. So part of our military culture training is highlighting those differences between the branches, but also marrying them all together in a strengths-based perspective. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a final comment.
Sure.
I would think in terms of, and this is just my own very small personal experience with two different members of the military in our fire service, a volunteer fire service. You know, like, they all had they've had combat experience, so you want those guys on a bad highway accident scene, because they're not going to be fazed by it, really. They're going to kick into gear. They know what to do medically to get the person treated and off, you know, to the hospital. Mm-hmm. They're used to the command structure. But in some cases, give me a break here, Mr. Professional Firefighter. You never know who's going to show up. You know, you might get two people with six victims or whatever. So my point is if a supervisor can understand, maybe you have a factory or whatever, a business, you have an emergency event or something, I would hope that part of their training is, hey, you've got somebody who's got combat experience here, and they're a medic or whatever, you need to make sure that they are in a position that if this happens, they're on first. And, you know, it's valuable in that sense, and I don't think you want any, structure of, well, I'm in charge. No, I'm in charge, you know. And we've been very lucky, and we're always happy to have a veteran on our scenes, because they know what to do. I mean, when they're traveling through from Camp Rylea to Salem, and they have stopped, this has happened, and we'll step back and let them do it, maybe just make sure that at least gets mentioned.
Absolutely. That is part of our ethos. We always step up and do what's necessary.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just thinking that there might be opportunities with a number of chambers of commerce around the state to make a similar presentation for recruitment purposes, and I don't know whether Ms. Matthews has thought about that yet, but I just thought that I'd make that suggestion.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Yes, we actually just had a conversation with Sean Files with Commissioner McKeel's office. She's been very instrumental in getting us here today, and he did mention that, and I think that's something that we're going to pursue. I know that other people on my team have presented to DAS, and I hope that progresses to a positive end. So thank you for the suggestion, yes.
And that's a good suggestion. There was a group, and I think Colonel Doctor, I believe, was part of the group, but they used to go out and perhaps still do, talk to a lot of the businesses about USERRA, right, and an educational effort. And as we're seeing a little bit of a general doctor, maybe, did I demote him by chance? Sure. He's a great man, and I apologize. But that might be a way to follow up, too. They've got their foot in the door a number of times for veteran hiring practices and whatnot, so that might be the same. Any other questions? So I just have a couple of quick ones. You had mentioned the 24.8% unemployment rate for our veterans age 18 to 24. Compared to what's the average if you're not a veteran?
In that age group?
Yeah.
Well, if I can remember the graph, I think it's about 11.4.
Okay. And we mentioned civilian employment, but is this to public employers and private sector, or just private sector?
Government agencies.
Given the names of the endorsers,
right.
I would think there's a few folks that could be easily compelled to participate in the study at a state level.
Right. Yes, we welcome government agencies. We welcome nonprofits. We welcome private organizations.
In addition to that, in terms of like getting a veteran on board, they get $25 to participate in the study, but in order to participate in the study, they have to have the employer engage as well.
Absolutely. So that's the hat trick, as we like to call it.
It seems like it makes sense to go first for the employer that would support being a part of the study and then go through their employee base rather than try to get a bunch of veterans fired up that go to their bosses and say, you need to do this for me. Is that kind of your approach to this?
Absolutely. We have two recruiting streams. We have gone out to the PHAs. We've gone to Yellow Ribbon events and Family Day events for the military, and we've told them about the study. Of course, there's always those veterans that, you know, they don't want to disclose.
Right.
And that's their right. So we are also working on these employers. And by first reaching out to the veterans, we have a pretty good list of employers that we can reach out to and say, hey, you have been identified as the employer of a veteran. Would you mind talking to us about enrolling in this? We think that it could really help you in your bottom line. So that's the approach that we've been taking. Because you're right, it is the hat trick, as we like to call it. You have to get both on board. So right now, what we're doing is we're really concentrating on those employers. We have been working with ESGR. We have roughly 3,000 leads across the state of Oregon. But of course, you know, with our timeline, we start our first randomization in May. And so we are starting our first real big recruiting push after last fall. And I'm hoping that by concentrating more on these employers, now that we have their names, and having good folks like you talk us up, that we'll be able to accomplish that.
Wonderful. Great. Well, I sure compliment you on the work that you're doing, and thank you for the effort, and I wish you the best of luck. I know that it would be interesting to have follow-up to this once you do roll out, get going, and see what kind of success we're having with different businesses, and maybe even highlight some of the champions that are part of this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you. Are there any further questions of Ms. Matthews today? Thanks for coming to the Capitol Building. Enjoy your first visit. And
well done
today. And really appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time, Committee. Thanks.
Great. And with that, committee members, our agenda is complete for the day. So we'll close that informational hearing. And we are...
What's that? Your agenda and a bit more.
Yeah, our agenda and even more. Are there any comments for the good of the order from the committee members? Seeing none, to the hundreds in the audience and the millions at home, thanks for joining us today. And we will close the interim House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. Thank you so much. We are adjourned.